Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome back to another episode of Monuments, Museums, and Mojitos podcast.
Woo!
The last one for this season.
This is, yeah, the finale of season two.
Oh, that's a bit sad, but also exciting because that means summer is coming.
Summer is coming, and as you probably know from our previous season, basically the whole of Southern Europe shuts down during summer. So we know work, we align with the cultural traditions here and also yeah. Take a break.
It's purely ethnographic.
Yeah. Nice way to put it. I'm going to start using that in my arguments with my bosses.
It's cultural.
As you can see, also Nikki's back to Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And already quickly adjusting to the European trends of doing anything during the summer.
It's nice for us to be back recording in the old stomping ground of Athens.
So what are we drinking, guys?
Well, today we are coming to you with a very, very special drink. An episode, in fact. So today we are diving into the glorious topic that is food. Food and drink. Food and drink throughout time, food and drink from ancient times until now, its social implications, its relations to power, just how food has been celebrated, perceived, used, and enjoyed throughout eternity.
Don't know about the drink, if it's tasty.
Well, back to the drink.
I'm a bit skeptical.
We were inspired by this podcast from a fella named Tom Dinas with his podcast Delicious Legacy. And basically he talks about food in the ancient world throughout time, but we particularly listened to an episode on food in the Greco-Roman world where this recipe that we're drinking today comes from. So this recipe comes from the book of Apicius, who was a chef in antiquity. And basically it's a fine spiced wine. Mulled wine nowadays, you can get similar things, I think, all over the world. And basically it's white wine, bay leaves, lots of honey, crushed pepper, saffron, and a few things that I don't even know exist in our modern societies. So we had to modify it a little, but we did try and keep it true to authenticity by using ingredients that are only found in the Greco-Roman world at the time, because we have to remember that they didn't have everything like we have today.
A lot of the things we might associate with the Mediterranean now, I mean, we'll discuss this in depth later, but a lot of those ingredients weren't available back then, including citrus. So no citrus included.
Yeah. So should we give it a whirl?
Yep.
We actually haven't tried it yet, and it could be questionable because it's a leave overnight situation.
Let's give it a go.
There's black pepper in this, like black pepper in a drink, I'm unsure, but let's give it a go. Oh my god, wow.
It's surprisingly good.
That's actually really pleasant.
Yeah, that is good. I mean, I love a cider, but it tastes like cider, don't you think?
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean,
think it's also kind
funny.
Of summery, to be honest. Maybe I think with ice could go really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not hot. Even though it's mulled, we're having it cold.
Yeah.
So it's like,
authenticity.
Yeah.
No it fridges was. Or stoves yeah. back then. Well, they had fire, yeah. I guess, but they couldn't keep it warm.
It was cooked last night with the honey, is that correct?
Yeah, so like the night before you put some measurements of honey and wine together, but not your whole bottle of wine, and then take it off the stove, have to sieve out some stuff that builds on top, and then do that process three times. And you know what, whilst I was doing that, I felt really nicely connected to our ancient ancestors and how they would have enjoyed some mulled wine.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's fair enough. Stretching back through the ages, especially in Athens, seeing as you're here.
True.
In the land of the ancestors.
Yeah.
The land
yeah.
of your ancestors.
Food and drink is something that is shared with every culture, every people in the world. It's something that binds everyone together.
Yep.
So regardless of, yes, this coming out from ancient Greece and Rome, I'm sure other cultures around the world also made their wines or drinks or even foods.
Bringing everyone closer together like we are today.
Yeah.
And as always, we will include our recipe on our social media. So if you would like to make your very own version, then just check us out there and you can join us in an ancient wine.
So guys, what's up with food?
What's it all about?
Oh, wait. First, what's everyone's favorite food?
Probably say it's a... chicken tikka masala.
Really?
So British. Okay,
look,
fair.
I really like those stuffed cabbage leaves because this cabbage is left to ferment for a few months. So it's like you have this very vinegar taste.
My favorite food is rice paper rolls.
The Vietnamese ones.
Yeah, Viet food, rice paper rolls. I could eat them until I die. Well, yeah, that's interesting because our relationship with food today hasn't always been like this. It's changed a lot throughout time. And particularly if we wind all the way back to antiquity, we have a pretty different situations with eating.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned before, a lot of the things that you might associate with food of a certain country or culture now is not at all what the ancient people of that country or culture would have been eating, which is a really interesting thing that I hadn't thought of previously. Like, it was really only while I was doing research for this that I was like, oh, wow, like, who would have thought that such quintessential dishes were a very modern invention?
Yeah.
And I feel that our food habits and food in general will change immensely in the next few decades because we have the climate change going on. We have the issue of eating meat. Then we have the big problem of developing nations wanting to eat more meat because that's what people assume with prosperity, eating more meat. Then you have also the habit of eating meat and certain types of food during holidays or during celebrations, which you can't change the habit created during thousands of years just for the sake of climate change, you know? And we also have this thing of the developed world eating more seasonal food. How are you gonna sell that to Westerners, telling them, well, guys, sorry, but you have to eat Dutch tomatoes and not Greek tomatoes because there is less carbon footprint, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, food will change immensely in the next few decades.
Yeah, that's a good point, because especially, like, I think in Northern European countries, especially in the UK, like, I know from my own experience, any time of the year you can walk into a supermarket and buy the fruit that you want, no matter whether it's seasonal or not. Like, you could just walk in and in December you'll have strawberries, you'll have raspberries, you'll have whatever pineapple, whatever you went in to buy will be there. Whereas Greece definitely has a different attitude to that. I don't know whether that's because it's too expensive for supermarkets to import things, but they definitely are a lot more seasonal with what they provide, so you do only get certain types of food at the time of year that they're grown.
Or another thing that I remember now is that because of social media and how everything is all connected, certain fruits or veggies become really popular, like avocado, and the demand for avocado, for example, or quinoa increases the price of those products, which immediately impacts the local community, which have been feeding from this food for centuries.
Yeah, we have to be more conscious of going forward that we can't just have everything that we want available all the time. We have to be a lot more aware of the environmental impact.
Definitely, Maybe we need to reconnect with our ancestral roots and only use what we have access to around us.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to think of that, isn't it, when you've grown up in a society where you passion fruit on Wednesday.
Yeah. Like, literally. But it's about reshaping our habits, probably. I think this has come a little bit into light, especially with, like, veganism and kind of the push towards being more conscious of your environmental footprint. It's like we need to stop probably feeling like we're a bit spoiled with having everything all the time.
Because it's probably, only the last 70, 80 years that has started to become a thing anyway. And now we just completely take it for granted.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, definitely post-Second World War, I'd say.
What I love about archaeology and food is that it can be hard to interpret things in archaeology in the ancient world, obviously. But when you find, say, a site that is full of pottery that is typical of cookware, you can almost certainly be like, oh, this was a kitchen. Or there's fragments of the actual foods that were within that. And through scientific technologies, we can see that was this ingredient. They were using this type of ingredient. It's such a rich source of information for us.
Yeah, that's something that's definitely, in the last like 10 to 20 years, has definitely taken 360 turn and like is now really central to understanding ancient cultures, because we've made these developments to really look into what it was that they were eating. I mean, it is nice that we have records in terms of mosaics and wall paintings that depict, say, feasts, but on an everyday basis, it's hard, or it has been historically harder for us to really interpret what people would have been eating. But now we've really made some great developments in terms of that. So I was going to share with you some of the recent findings that we have come across as not we.
We wish.
that archaeologists have come across in recent years. So I'll start with taking us all the way back to ancient Egypt. Oh yeah.
Our fave.
Yeah, good one. So there are some things that we kind of would associate with ancient Egypt. Like, it kind of all makes sense. They're one of the earliest societies to drink beer, which we know from both like paintings and archaeological evidence. We spoke a little bit in our pyramids episode. Shout out to the pyramids episode. Go check that out if you haven't listened to it. And we spoke a little bit in that about how there's been evidence that the workers were paid, or at least many of them were paid, maybe not everyone. And one of the things that they were paid in was beer. So they were given like 3 portions of beer per day for working on the pyramids.
Not bad.
It would probably be weaker than we imagine it today, because it wasn't something that was meant to get you intoxicated. But true. Like, it was the drink that you just drank through the day. But yeah, it's interesting to know that they kind of valued that enough to be paid in it.
Yeah.
Another thing that the Egyptians loved was wine. And they didn't just stop at like grape wine, as we think of it today. They experimented with literally everything they could ferment. So,
wow. Sounds like making raki.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, basically. So they had palm sap wine, poppy seed wine.
Wow.
Pomegranates. Ooh. Carob seeds.
Wow.
So yeah, anything that they could ferment, they went ahead and did it. Honey was obviously the miracle food of the ancient world across all cultures. Because the amazing thing about honey is that it just doesn't go off. Like, you don't have to do anything.
True.
To it.
Yeah.
It just never goes bad. And it can be used to sweeten food, to soften food if you bake with it. It can be used in like a million different ways. And like in the wine that we're drinking today. And it's also interesting that they had access to a lot of spices that we would still kind of think of as quite fancy today. So stuff like cumin, coriander, cinnamon, those were all used by the ancient Egyptians. Cinnamon, they used a lot in like the embalming process. And a lot of the spices and herbs that they used, they did have kind of medicinal properties that they associated with them, which the Greeks also did, probably. Spoke to each other across the Med. But yeah, it's just an interesting thing to think. Like, I don't know, when I look at like recipes that I make today, like a good old chili con carne, and I put in plenty of cumin, like, just to think that the ancient Egyptians were already cooking with it, like, 4,000 years ago. Oh.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that their perception of food, like other cultures, like, say, Greece, friends across the Med, it was obviously for sustenance, but it was also for, yeah, like you said, medicinal purposes. So they had like a lot more thought behind their cooking. Like, I'm putting cumin in, which is also anti-inflammatory, for example, for either particular ailments or just general well-being.
I think they also associated it with digestion, and also there was kind of a link to the family, the home, and faithfulness because of that, because it was like a digestive aid. I don't really know how those things correlate, but they kind of do, like, in that slightly spiritual way, I guess.
Yeah.
Faithful.
Yeah.
Something dependable that you can rely on to help you. Cumin. Yeah.
Yeah. Go cumin.
Go cumin. Going on from that, some of the meat that they had access to, a lot of them did eat pork, but that was seen as unclean by the higher classes. So it would only be the poorer people who ate pork. Whereas if you were wealthy enough, then you would skip the pork and go straight on to sheep, goats, cow, oryx, goose, and duck. And then if you were really fancy, like pharaoh level, you would also eat pheasants, pigeons, and ostriches. But an interesting thing to note was that chicken was not on the menu until the Ptolemies came along.
The Ptolemies.
Yeah, it's not kind of native to the area. So it was only when the Greeks arrived and mixed things up, they brought their chickens with them. Let's move on to the Babylonians.
Ooh.
So I only found one recipe from Babylon, but it sounded really interesting. It was a lamb and beet stew that they used to make at New Year festivals. So their New Year would be kind of March time. So it'd be the coming of spring, coming of the New Year. So it wasn't like kind of midwinter like we think of it today. It would be very associated with the spring. So when the lambs were frolicking.
Oh, yes.
Get them and put them in a stew.
Look, that's very interesting. It's the same thing in Bulgaria, in the Rhodope Mountains. It's the same thing in Greece. Lamb, you eat it mainly during spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, spring lamb.
Easter, sad. In the Balkans, always you eat lamb because it's in spring.
Yeah. True. So that's something going back to ancient times.
Yeah.
So this recipe, it was found on a cuneiform tablet and it was from 1740 BCE.
Wow.
So like it's old.
Yeah.
And what they did with the lamb, they would stew it in beer, salt, onion. They would add in coriander seeds and the leaves, then also add some rocket and beetroot, leeks and garlic and all kind of stew that up
together. That sounds nice.
That sounds like a gourmet restaurant.
That sounds like from BBC Food, you know, when you search for lamb recipes.
Yeah, if you went to like a Lebanese restaurant or something to do, I can imagine having. Like, sounds like proper Middle Eastern cuisine as this. Yeah. It would still be eaten. So the next civilization who I'm looking at today would be ancient Rome. and as we know from our Pompeii episode, shout out to our Pompeii episode, check that out if you haven't already. there has been so much archaeological evidence that has been found there that was found in either ovens that were just kind of frozen in time after the eruption, or in the sewers from what's, you know, now been excavated, because that was all preserved. So you found literal human poops.
Useful.
So yeah, but super useful for archaeologists. Yeah. Like, we kind of go like, ew, but then we go, interesting.
Yeah.
Because it really highlights what people were eating at the time, both of high class and like regular everyday people. Which is something we haven't had a lot of previously. So when it comes to Pompeii and Herculaneum, there were 110 different food items which have been discovered, and kind of preconceptions of what Romans ate have been turned upside down by what they found, because there was always this assumption that the poor people, as we mentioned, would not be eating meat. So it would be poor people who, you know, they would only have meat on special occasions. But actually, because it was a very seaside kind of, it was a very cosmopolitan and wealthy place, even the kind of lowliest people were eating a lot of seafood. So that's a really interesting take on ancient diets. So there were 46 different fish species that have been found through like bones that were in the sewer, mostly the undigested bones. And they were eating everything from kind of the anchovies, sardines, and sea bream that we would kind of think of, sea bass, that kind of thing. But also they ate sharks, rays, eels, sea urchins.
Wow.
Yeah, they had a really varied seafood diet. They also consumed it in a slightly different way. So they would eat like the whole fish, including the head. There's also kind of everything that you would imagine, like the pomegranates, eggs, walnuts, apples, pears, figs, and olives. But as we mentioned earlier, there are a lot of dishes that would not have been available. So you kind of associate, especially Italian food, with your tomato sauces and, you know, all of those kinds of rich foods, of aubergines, maybe some rice, maybe some pasta. But there was, as we mentioned, no lemons or oranges, and also no rice or aubergines, because that all came from the Arab world later on. So none available at the time. And also tomatoes, peppers, chilies, and potatoes all came from the Americas.
Yeah.
Isn't that so strange to think?
It is, yeah. Something that's so prominent in, yeah, Italian and even Greek cooking today.
Yeah.
I find that really interesting, particularly because if you know me, I love the etymology of words. And something that I came across a while back was the etymology of the word companion. Does anyone know where it comes from? Do we know what it means?
Yeah, we know companion.
Like a friend.
Like a friend, yeah. Like a partner.
Someone you hold in like dear respect, close to your heart.
Yeah.
Companion comes from the Latin word with, con, and pan, which is bread. And it literally means those who break bread together.
Oh, isn't that nice?
So when men break bread together or toast to a queen or slaughter for one another like they did in ancient times, at that point, they're saying we've become equal. We are now allies. So it actually held a really high social meaning to eat with fellow men and women during ancient times. But what is particularly interesting is how this was projected kind of onto women, or I should say away from women. So food, as well as being a nourishing source for people, has also been a symbol of social worth. Basically, in a society, who it values, it feeds them well. And there's this argument that particularly comes from the feminist author Naomi Wolf in her book The Beauty Myth, that basically states that I guess what we would call diet culture today, the restricted eating and deprivation of calories, particularly towards women, has massive social implications and had massive social implications for them. So things like dieting culture haven't always been modern. So even in Hellenistic Rome, boys were rationed 16 measures of meal to 12 measures allotted to girls. In medieval France, women received 2/3 of grain allocated to men. And we continually see this throughout time, including in more modern times where British miners' wives just ate grease-soaked bread while their husbands ate the meat, and Italian and Jewish wives take the part of the bird that no one else wants. And basically what Wolf argues is that by depriving women from food in societies is actually taking away their, I guess, equal access to society and power. Because in its most basic form, firstly, if anyone in society isn't eating correctly, they're malnourished. They don't have the caloric needs and energy to go on and, I guess, work their way up in society as well. And in a more modern context, the beauty myth argues that the obsession with lack of eating and lack of food replaces the myth of the feminine mystique, which was Betty Friedan's book, which basically was challenging the notion that a woman's place is within the household, and that's how women were kind of kept in check. So food also has a really strong social role to play. And in this example, it's through how it's been used as a tool to deprive women of equal access to food, but I guess more so in society as well.
Yeah, because those like Roman banquets or big Roman dinner parties, it would not be for everyone to attend. Like it would be for the boys to get together and have their boys' night and talk about their politics or just get roaring drunk together. But the ladies were not invited. So this big feast that they might have with like glazed prawns and all of their fancy meats and things, that wasn't something that the women could be a part of. So what were the women eating?
So like if the women couldn't eat the same food as men, they couldn't experience equal status in the community.
Yeah, because these political decisions were made over dinner. Oh, it's all making sense.
Yeah.
It's all feeding into each other.
It is. It's got another side to the coin that's interesting to look at. So this notion of food being a symbol of power obviously isn't just restricted to women. It's also eminent in class systems with, like you said, the rich having more access to certain foods while the poor are deprived from others, and the social meaning certain foods held. And I think we can look at this from a colonialism lens where literally lands were torn apart for certain food and drink resources.
Mm-hmm. And continuing with Rissan's references, there are plenty of colonialism heritage topics in our podcast. Yeah.
And listen if you haven't already.
I don't know if you know, but spices have been causing wars throughout history constantly, mainly for economic terms. Spices, for example, came to play a significant role in the success of the Dutch economy, one of the biggest empires in the world that we know. The Dutch, they didn't enter into the spice race by themselves until the end of 16th century, but they got interested in that following their engagement with the Portuguese, because Portuguese are one of the first nations which started exploring the profits of the spices. Also, as Amsterdam became the biggest distribution center for spices by overtaking Hamburg as a major port in Europe, Dutch sailors started noticing that the more ships which arrive with spices, the more profit they make. For example, spices carried by ships would earn a profit of 400%.
Wow.
And demand for spices had a long history with dependable returns which were easily understood by investors. So it's very easy. You just go, take them, and it's very easy to sell. It's very easy to calculate how much profit you will make. So it's a very good commodity, you know, to make money with. However, they're a bit too optimistic. So they started sending more and more ships for spices. And when you come with more and more spices, then the price obviously falls down, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, several centuries they understood that this wasn't a very good strategy. But anyway, in the meantime, they caused several wars. They killed many people in Indonesia and so on. So for example, let's take a look at the case of the Spice Islands. Have you heard about the Spice Islands, guys?
No, where are they?
In Indonesia. Mm-hmm. They're called currently Moluccas. And today, 2 million people live there. So the Moluccas have been inhabited for tens of thousands of years. And the native people there have been trading spices since they exist. And even before the first Europeans set foot on the islands. And in the 16th century, the Moluccas were nicknamed the Spice Islands. And this was due to the large number of aromatic plants that grew there. And the islands became an important strategic base for the highly profitable spice trade. Nutmeg and cloves largely drove the spice trade. And these two widely used spices were originally only native to this group of islands.
Oh, really? So you can get nutmeg or cloves anywhere else, just here in Indonesia?
Yeah, originally, yeah. And since spices were once worth their weight in gold, control of the Moluccas was synonymous with extreme wealth. You know Vasco da Gama, the guy that discovered India. The moment he discovered India, so he passed through those islands, and then the Portuguese were like, okay, we need to go there and start exploiting them. Mm-hmm. So the Portuguese established several bases on the Spice Islands in 1520. And soon a bidding war started between the British, the Dutch, the Spanish, the usual villains. And yeah, and eventually the Dutch emerged victorious at the middle of 17th century. And they were in control of the spice monopoly there. So they were the only ones who could have access to those products. The monopoly was challenged in 18th century when a Frenchman smuggled nutmeg. And he was successful in cultivating them in Mauritius. So yeah. Until 18th century, the only nutmeg that the world had access to was the one from Indonesia.
Wow.
Yeah, just one very interesting case. Another famous Portuguese explorer, Fernando Magellan, who became the first person to go around the world. So he wanted to access India from the west, right? So he first went to the tip of South America, then to the Philippines, and then to the southern coast of Africa before finally heading back to Spain. However, there were 5 ships launched with Magellan and only one returned. So 5 ships launched on this mission to go around the world. Okay. Only one returned. However, this one ship was loaded with 26 tons of spices. After deducting the cost of all the lost ships and etc., a net profit of 50 gold coins still remained.
Wow, so there was still a profit
even
after they
lost. Yes, so just they sent 5 ships, only one return with 26 tons of spices. And after calculating all the costs, they still made a profit of 500 gold coins. You can imagine how expensive were spices.
Yeah.
Another similar product which caused a lot of misery in the world is sugar. So we know the extraordinary mass commodification of sugar nowadays and its economic impact and the impact on all our diets and health, right? However, in Europe for a long time, refined sugar was a luxury product. And it is reasonable to imagine that it might have remained so if it weren't for the establishment of an enormous market in enslaved laborers who had no way to opt out of that work. So for thousands of years, sugarcane was a heavy and very difficult to grow crop, you know, and to be treated. In order to reach to a stage of crystals, you needed to pass through a huge amount of work and process. So it was a very native plant. It stayed in lands in the world where people had access to it and they had time to process it, you know. However, with the introduction of sugar slavery in the new world, that changed everything. There is this book called Sugar Changed the World, and indeed it says that the true age of sugar had begun and it was doing more to reshape the world than any ruler, empire or war had ever done. Over 4 centuries following Columbus' arrival in South America, countless indigenous lives were destroyed and nearly 11 million Africans were enslaved to work on sugar plantations. Yeah. That's why we call sugar the white gold, because it drove trade in goods and people and it fueled the wealth of European nations. So you can imagine the triangle, enslaved people from Africa on one side, sugar from the West Indies and Brazil on the other, and money and manufacturers from Europe. So people were traded along the bottom of the triangle, while profits would stick to the top. A very interesting case was that in end of 18th century, a Frenchman became a sugar planter in New Orleans. he discovered how he can process sugar quite rapidly, and he started exploiting sugar plantations down the banks of Mississippi. And this obviously became possible by the rich soil of the land, combined with the technical mastery of the French and Spanish planters, and a third very important component, slaves coming from the Caribbean. So just for statistics, within 5 decades, Louisiana planters were producing a quarter of the world's cane sugar supply. Louisiana became the second richest state per capita in wealth in the US during that time. According to historians, the state ranked third in banking capital behind New York and Massachusetts in 1840. Basically, the value of enslaved people alone represented tens of millions of dollars in capital that financed investments, loans, and businesses. Basically, the enslaved population soared so much that it quadrupled over a 20-year period just because of that they needed this workforce to work on these sugar canes. New Orleans kind of became like a Walmart of people selling. I read that one historian found that Louisiana sugar parishes had a pattern of deaths exceeding births. The intense labor and the malnutrition meant that slaves working on sugar plantations, comparing with other working age slaves in the US, slaves working in Louisiana were far less able to resist to the common and life-threatening diseases like dirt or poverty. For example, life expectancy was less like that on a cotton plantation, and closer to that of a Jamaican cane field, where most overworked and abused could drop dead after 7 years. The good thing is, obviously now slavery is abolished. However, even with the delivery of civil rights, white planters continued to dominate land ownership, and freedmen and free women had little choice but to live in somebody's old slave quarters. Everything continued kind of the same. Obviously now people had wages, they could negotiate better terms. However, the person on top were again the same white men that were 100 years ago. And some people even argue that sugar plantations did a better job in preserving racial hierarchy than other sectors.
Yeah, I actually recently saw an interview with a historian, and he said that the history of racism is completely linked to the slave trade and sugar cane, because slavery was abolished. There was a movement in especially like Christian circles to see all men as equal, and therefore, you know, it's kind of condemning these plantation owners to say like they're doing a bad thing and they're killing these people and it's terrible what they're doing. And so there was kind of like almost a PR stunt to launch at this kind of real radical racism to say that people from the African continent couldn't create art and culture, they were less than, they were, you know, worthless as people, in this kind of conspiracy to continue the slave trade. So these attitudes hadn't always been ingrained in people. It wasn't like racism had kind of always been at the forefront of people's minds. It was almost like a new wave, just as an excuse to carry on slavery, which I thought was just astounding that is still, you know, there are still attitudes, especially Confederate South attitudes today, that kind of just come from this web of lies. And we know from our previous episode on the Benin Bronzes that the African continent is full of art and culture, and, you know, it's so rich in different religions and creativity. And all of this was kind of just denied, and it continued to be denied for generations. Even when archaeological evidence was found, it was often attributed to the Persians or the Greeks or another civilization to say that, it couldn't have been African because the Africans couldn't be, they're not worthy of this, they're not capable of this. And isn't that just such a crazy thing that it was all just to justify?
There was this article that I was reading in New York Times exactly about the Louisiana state, and they've obviously created a museum depicting working on the sugarcane plantations and the life of slaves there. And in some hotels, they inform white people that this is not true, this is misrepresentation, you know. So it's still happening nowadays that they're trying, not denying, but they're trying, let's say, to water down. I think that's better. They're not denying, they're watering down what has been happening there.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And it was in the benefit of the slaves.
Yeah.
taken care of. You know, people still get married on sugar plantation, like ranches, don't they?
And I
was reading this article where there was someone who had gone to like one of the tours, because they have tours there, and it was all kind of Gone with the Wind style. It was all kind of, you know, the benevolent white folks taking care of their slaves, and it was in everyone's best interest. And that's the story that they sell, because that's the story they believe often in the Confederate Deep South. That's the story that they've grown up with, and they think that it was the best thing for everyone. And no, it's all a lie. It's all a lie just for profits, people.
That's
super,
it's beyond problematic, isn't it?
Like, I don't know what to call that. It's like,
and there was one plantation in particular who was telling the true story, saying how horrible it was. And a lot of white Southern Americans who went there left it terrible reviews on like TripAdvisor and stuff, because they were like telling lies about our history. It's like, it's twisting things. We didn't go here for this. We didn't want a lecture on morals.
Oh my goodness.
What did you go to a plantation for? Honestly.
Yeah.
Oh God, So like this is, stemming from the hot commodity that was sugar. It's something that we just take for granted in almost everything nowadays, which is actually probably like, I think it's literally like a bit of an epidemic. There's like a sugar problem in our societies today, especially through like soft drinks and junk food and the problematic nature that has, particularly on the youth of society.
Yes.
And it's addictive.
Yeah.
But it changed our way of eating, also preserving food.
And where we used to use honey.
Yeah.
So something I've learned in my life, and I'm sure all of us can agree with, is that food affects your mood. Mm-hmm. If you're hungry, you're grumpy, you're hangry, you're not feeling great, you can't really perform that well. And what I think is interesting is when we kind of look beyond this lens of food as a source to sever our hunger or its wine and dine purposes, it's actually got, you know, its core integral role to keep us alive, healthy, active, and strong. And when we look at events in society, such as famines, such as wars, such as natural disasters, where the source of food is cut off, this directly impacts the population at hand, of course, and its progression into the future. And something that I find really interesting is this notion of battlefield archaeology, which is basically a subdiscipline of archaeology that looks at the surface of battlefields through technologies only looking at topography. So there's no digging. It's just what's on the surface and what our technologies like kind of x-ray machines can see beyond the surface. And there's one example that comes from Gallipoli in modern day Turkey, which, if you don't know what that is in its historical sense, it was a battle during the First World War between the Allies and the then Ottoman Turkish nation, where the Allied forces, which includes the Australian and New Zealand fighters known as the Anzacs, which has become a very popular event, or commemorative event, I should say, in Australia. But basically, it led to the terrible failure of the Allies and the overwhelming victory of the Turkish army.
It was like one of the worst disasters of the First World War, pretty much.
It was really bad.
From the Allied perspective.
And there was this project carried out by the University of Melbourne that undertook battlefield archaeology on this particular plane. And what researchers were able to understand was the diet and calorie intake of the Turkish soldiers. Now, of course, they were on their terrain, so they had more access to foods and resources than the Allies, who had come from all over the world. But they found, and this is only on the Turkish side, things like brick ovens, abattoirs, access to fresh fruit and vegetables. And something that's really interesting is that there's no processed or industrialized foods, because at that point, the food industry had not yet developed in the Ottoman Empire. So literally these guys were eating the best of the best, the creme de la creme. And this could be argued as affecting their performance on this battlefield, because the Allies, all evidence we find of that and all we know, is that they were literally eating the most processed foods like belly beef that arrived in a can. And of course, things like the iconic Anzac biscuits, which is pretty much like oats, sugar, flour, and honey. And of course, there was like more than one reason why it went horribly wrong for the Allies. But when you think about the relationship food has with our ability to perform and, I guess, strength in its basic sense, is it really a surprise, or could it really be a contributing factor to why, in this example, the Allies and Anzacs, or all battles or all incidences that do align with the deprivation of food, result in poorer performance?
It's been a deciding factor for so many, you know, battles throughout history, that supply lines were cut, so they couldn't get their food, or, you know, their food train was broken by, you know, a pincer movement or something. And that has happened time and time again.
And I don't know about anyone else, but with my grandparents or the older generations, where they force you to eat the food on the plate and they give you the examples that we didn't have secure access to this growing up, or referring to other periods in history or parts of societies where they don't have the flourishing arrival of food like we do today. Like, it's definitely something we really take for granted. So, in the words of Virginia Woolf, one cannot think well, sleep well, love well, if one has not dined well.
Yes.
That's very true.
It is. Yeah.
I do get hangry.
Same. Everyone, I think.
It's a universal suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys. I think that we've earned our lunch.
Fruitful discussion.
Yeah.
And I have to say, this mulled wine situation was the bee's knees.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Very sweet for me, my taste. But yeah, nice.
Yeah, it was good. You guys should definitely try it. Don't be put off by the fact that it's from thousands of years ago. It is yum.
Yeah. It's a resounding yes from all of us, even Polly, even if he's like being grumpy about it. That's just Polly.
Yeah.
So that's a wrap for season two.
Yeah.
Goodbye from us for now. Thank you to all our listeners this season. We appreciate your support so much, and we really look forward to creating new episodes and content for you in a few months.
Yeah.
We will be back.
We promise.
We promise.
And we'll keep in touch on social media. Feel free to reach out to us with episode suggestions for the future, or if you are a historian or archaeologist and you would like to feature on one of our episodes, we are open to guest spots.
Yeah. We are.
So come join us.
Share, like, comment.
Subscribe.
5 stars.
Rate us.
Yeah, 5 stars on Spotify and Apple.
Yeah.
Please.
And give us a little rating on there. It really helps.
Yeah.
And watch this space for potential merch coming.
Yeah, we're going to drop something soon. Stay tuned in a few weeks.
Right, Justin Bieber.
Like, maybe now.
Our new album.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.